Right, so Mark, Mark has once again confused me, but it's not Mark's fault, it's my fault. So I used what I thought was the daily reading for the day, which is Acts 17. It turns out it's not Acts 17. My Bible reading planner on my phone gets horribly confused by time zones. A few weeks ago when I presided, I gave out the wrong daily readings and got a couple of frowns, and that was fine. And I checked the calendar and against the paper plan, and it's all fine. But when I actually click into it and do things, it picks the wrong day. So I'm exhorting on tomorrow's reading, which is Acts 17, which seems like a very good basis for an exhortation. And it's a chapter in which Paul preaches in three separate locations, and a chapter which provides a number of notable quotes that certainly stick in my mind and may well stick in yours. If you recall last time, I also referenced the podcast that I'm listening to, The Surprising Rebirth of a Belief in God. I'm still listening to it, and it's certainly influenced some of the thinking in this exhortation. The way that that podcast articulates how the teaching of Jesus turned the world upside down, as those Jews in Thessalonica complained about, is really very impressive, and probably something that we take for granted. So let's start with that concept. It's something that we don't think about very often, or perhaps something we marginalize as something less universal than reality. So Acts 17 and verse 6, when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have turned the world upside down have come here too, and Jason has welcomed them. They are all acting contrary to Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, Jesus." And I think that we generally have a tendency to focus here on this opposition to Caesar and to highlight how crazy it seems for the oppressed Jews to be siding with the Roman leadership here. But it's not immediately obvious to me that this talk of there being another king was turning the world upside down. It's not as if this concept of kingship or leadership of independent nations was a new thing. For those of us that were at Bible school, we could think about Brother John's talks about Luke and his writing of Acts, how that Luke has a tendency to minimize any immediate threat to the Roman Empire from this, what we could think of as an upstart religion. And indeed, he was trying to show that it was, or Luke was trying to show that it was a branch of Judaism. But in this particular instance, the Jews are portraying Paul's teaching as a threat to Caesar. But that seems to be because they have no other basis on which they can cause trouble. The real problem was that this Jewish leadership were also threatened by those more insidious teachings of Jesus that each life has value. It does not matter whether you are rich or poor, Samaritan or a real Jew, publican or Pharisee. Each had the opportunity to please God and can be rewarded for doing so. We have probably forgotten, because we have grown up in an era in the Western world where this is considered inviolable, that an individual having rights and being equal before God is not a concept that has always existed. It's not even true all over the globe, but we should be grateful that it is accepted where we are. People as property was the norm 2,000 years ago, and it hasn't been that long since it wasn't true in the Western world. But that was the kind of teaching that was starting to turn the world upside down. These Jews, however, were not happy because it threatened their way of life and they were presumably particularly unhappy with the doctrine of resurrection, as this seems to be the focus of Paul's teaching. Acts chapter 17 and verse 2. As usual, Paul went to the synagogue and on three Sabbath days reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer and rise from the dead. This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah. So there would be two issues with this as far as the Jews were concerned. Firstly, Paul is basically pointing out that they had got it wrong in killing Jesus, and then, to top it off, that this resurrection was a thing. And yet in that, there was nothing that they could use to kick them out of the city, so they had to use this concept of a threat to Caesar as their reason. As Paul moves on to Berea, we see more of this world turning upside down, as Luke highlights another peculiar phenomenon that was occurring with this new doctrine. Chapter 17 and verse 11. The people here were of a more noble character than those in Thessalonica, since they received the word with eagerness and examined the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. Consequently, many of them believed, including a number of the prominent Greek women, as well as men. So as we see, Luke specifically highlights that the Greek women were also converting to the gospel that Paul was teaching. This is probably also related to the ideas we referenced earlier around the people as property concept, and this was not what Paul was preaching, and so it seemed a fairly safe and sensible set of beliefs for those women to gravitate towards. However, the troublemakers were following, so Paul and company had to move on to Athens, where it seems that the inhabitants still have a great deal to teach us and those troublemaking Jews from Thessalonica. Verse 18, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also debated with him. Some said, "What is this ignorant show-off trying to say?" Others replied, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign deities, because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection." They took him and brought him to the Areopagus and said, "May we learn about this new teaching you are presenting? Because what you say sounds strange to us, and we want to know what these things mean." And while it seems that there were some who were immediately dismissive, there were also those who understood that the best way to move forwards in understanding is to listen, a skill which seems to be less and less in vogue as people's opinions polarize. Solomon tells us in Proverbs several times how important this listening and seeking is. Chapter 1 and verse 5, "Let a wise person listen and increase learning, and let a discerning person obtain guidance." Chapter 18 and verse 15, "The mind of the discerning acquires knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks it." But far more today, we see the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy that Jesus talks of in Matthew, chapter 13 and verse 14. You will listen and listen, but never understand. You will look and look, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown callous. Their ears are hard of hearing, and they have shut their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, and turn back, and I would heal them. But it's an interesting juxtaposition that this is immediately followed in verse 21 with, "Now all the Athenians and the foreigners residing there spent their time on nothing else but telling or hearing something new." The difference between then and now would seem to be that whilst everybody is keen to tell something new, they're not so keen to listen, so that they don't know whether the thing they're trying to say is new or not. This verse from Proverbs epitomizes this, chapter 18 and verse 13. "The one who gives an answer before he listens "This is foolishness and disgrace for him." The good news for Paul was that there were plenty who were willing to listen. And having picked up on the sheer number of idols that there were in the city, Paul opens with his famous lines. Verse 22, "People of Athens, I see that you are extremely religious in every respect. For as I was passing through and observing the objects of your worship, I even found an altar on which was inscribed, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." It sometimes probably feels to us that when looking around, the biggest change would seem to be from a belief in gods to a belief in no gods. And preaching the transition from one God to a different God is quite a disparate challenge to no God to there is a God. If you're starting with a belief in God, then you have some form of purpose. But if you have no God, then what do you have? Paul articulates this purpose very simply in verse 27. "He did this so that they might seek God, and that perhaps they might reach out and find him, though he is not far from each one of us." It is a simple way of articulating the reason for our creation, but it also embodies that we have a choice, and it is certainly not a guarantee that everyone is going to find him. Paul continues by showing that if you do find God, a change of behavior is required because judgment is coming. Verse 30. "Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God now commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has set a day when he is going to judge the world in righteousness by the man he has appointed. He has provided proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead." Once again, though, this concept of resurrection is a step too far for many. Verse 32, "When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some began to ridicule him, but others said, 'We'd like to hear from you again about this.'" This chapter is bookended by this doctrine of resurrection and shows that the core of this faith will always be divisive and to some the subject of ridicule. It does not matter that it is relatively easy to prove historically that Jesus actually lived and that there is pretty robust proof of his resurrection. For some, it will always be a step too far. It is core to us, though, as we know from Hebrews 11. Now, without faith, it is impossible to please God, since the one who draws near to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And we know that that reward is contingent on belief in resurrection, as is pointed out at the end of the chapter. All these were approved through their faith, but they did not receive what was promised. As a side note here, it is odd to consider that our statement of faith is written essentially chronologically, and so we don't see resurrection until 13 clauses in. When it's a huge foundation, it's really odd to find it, you know, halfway through. But as Paul tells the Corinthians, it really is important. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 12. "Now, if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation is in vain, and so is your faith." We see from earlier in Paul's letter that this was a known problem. The entire concept of death and resurrection was foreign to everyone. chapter 1 and verse 22. For the Jews ask for signs, and the Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. Acts 17 finishes with a little hope, though, pointing out, as Hebrews does, that we are not alone. Verse 33. So Paul left their presence. However, some people joined him and believed, including Dionysius the Areopagite, a woman named Damaris, and others with them. So, as we partake of these emblems, let us rejoice in the sure knowledge that he is risen.